If I see one more LinkedIn post or one more Instagram caption that's like, let's go on a journey with a rocket emoji, it like makes me want to barf. And I don't even think people are using like ChatGPT-4. I think they're on like the 3.5 and it's free. And it feels all the opposite of authentic or cool. And I think if you think about building brand for unscalable practices, we have true copywriters that might use AI if they can't think of a word, but we don't write ad copy that's AI-based. We don't write email copy or SMS copy or landing page copy. We have time allotted for original thought for every page we make, every ad we make. We are more manual, and I think more manual is great.
Content from real people equals instant credibility for your brand. Consumers today crave real connections with real people, and they're guarded about who they'll trust. Highly polished, branded content simply doesn't cut it anymore. Let MiniSocial build a network of powerful micro-influencers around your brand who all know and love your products. They'll create something compelling that resonates with their audience and deliver it directly to you for use across all your marketing channels. Yeah, that includes ads. Meet millennials and Gen Zers where they're already hanging out, in the feeds of their favorite influencers, and get started with MiniSocial. Ari, Daniel, welcome to the D2C podcast. I'm hanging with the original marketing millennials. How are you guys doing today?
I wouldn't call us the original. I bet there was marketing millennials before us. I think we just coined the term marketing millennials, but excited to be here.
How did, just because you guys are probably like, you're the biggest marketing community or the one of the most vibrant marketing communities on LinkedIn, for sure, probably the biggest. Let's start with just that community. How did that all come to be?
It really started as a LinkedIn post back in the day where I was just trying to test. I was a marketing ops manager. I wanted to test LinkedIn for organic reach, and I started posting random things on LinkedIn, and I saw it at organic reach. So then I was like, oh, I should probably be more niche about what I'm talking about. So I started talking about marketing because I wanted to show marketing ops managers knew more about marketing than they people think they do, not just tech and process and stuff like that. And then that led me to running out of ideas to what to post on LinkedIn. So I started a podcast where Ari had to help me come up with a lot of the ideas and branding and all that stuff behind the marketing millennials, the vibe, the what emails we send out to people. And then the podcast turned into a LinkedIn page. The LinkedIn page turned into a newsletter. And then now we're cruising. And then Ari, and she could talk about a little, then she still does a lot for the marketing millennials, but then branched off and have her little D2C newsletter. I mean, we're not little now, it's like over 50,000 people, but it spun off to her talking about go-to-market and D2C.
Very cool. How big is Marketing Millennials now on LinkedIn?
930K followers or something.
I didn't even think there's a million marketers on LinkedIn. That's impressive. Yeah. And then Ari, give me your hero's journey. How did you get into this crazy space?
Well, something everyone needs to know, which people don't know until the, like later on, but we're married. So just Murray is a common last name. So
yep. Power couple. Yes,
we get DM'd like daily. It's like, I did not know you guys were married. So we're married. So Daniel and I used to be coworkers. So when he had the Marketing Millennials and he was starting it, I just thought it was so cute supporting him. Like my dad and I would listen to it. We didn't see this coming, but it's so exciting that he made this happen. And then I've been at Charma Brands for almost 3 years. And then 2 years ago, I started Go to Millions, which is my e-commerce love letter. So it's basically a newsletter that it doesn't feel like a newsletter. It's more of a shopping blog, I hope, and meant to make sense of what I do all day and hopefully help people too. But it plays really nicely with the marketing millennials because Daniel's speaking to a different person. Mine is like true, like e-com heavy D2C, like very technical and also very shopping and very girly, to be honest. And then Daniel, what's yours? How do you describe it?
Yeah, mine, I would say it's like broad marketing. So B2B and some e-commerce stuff. And I like to call it the top of the T for marketers. So like the broad knowledge that everybody should know from marketing. So we dive into case studies, we dive into tips that I learned in marketing, we dive into like lessons I learned on the Market Millennials podcast. I'm cool marketers. So it's really just if you want to expand your marketing knowledge beyond just being, let's say, an email marketer, you can learn the breadth of marketing
and get a few laughs along the way. I know, exactly. I know you're, it's maybe not girly, but it's always topical and
it's
relevant.
Funny.
It's funny. Exactly. And are you're talking about what you do all day? Describe what you do at this. Cause I know you've been with Sharper Brands kind of since its beginning or close to it. What do you do at Sharper Brands?
I'm chief growth officer. So I oversee all teams. So I oversee every growth function, which is a growth agency. And so paid, CRM, CRO, design, creative, development, and account. And I am sort of the principal marketer of each of our clients. So every strategy we put forth, every creative, every website, it all is under my team.
And what was the company that you guys met at?
Daniel and I met at Snack Nation, which is defunct, but it's now called Karoo. And it is a subscription snack company that was actually super big. And it was the best first job. It was my first job I ever had. And Daniel was on the B2B and I was the e-com customer service agent. And it was a whole love story. We met on Zendesk. It's true.
Oh my God. So, that's beautiful. And yes. Knowing what you know now about growing brands, like I don't know, this isn't really about Snack Nation, but what were some of the things that went wrong at Snack Nation that you would have advised them as a head of growth at Sharper Brands not to do?
Yeah, well, Snack Nation is a B2B business that had an e-commerce arm, and B2B businesses that serve office snacks, that's pretty hard during COVID. And so that, I don't know if there's something you can advise. Sometimes the world is not on your side. But I haven't worked there since 2019. So I know that the business still is carrying on, just has a new name and a new strategy. And Daniel left in 2018 and deserted me. So I think they might have just like wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, that happens. And as opposed to D2C, which was right place, right time to be on the other side of the coin, right?
Yes, success.
During the huge boom post-COVID. So it's 2024. The e-commerce boom has subsided. The tide's gone out a little bit and everyone's on stilts. What are some of the big trends, Ari, that you're seeing at Sharma Brands of brands that are really winning in 2024?
Our brands that are winning are the brands that are like serving a product that is either unique or it's exactly like everyone else, but they're just quicker and faster. And so we work with a lot of supplement brands, and so they could all seem similar, but they each are taking a different angle and they're each selling to a different person. But the brands that under that same category in the same moment in time, the same like macro space, the ones that are like allowing for quick iterations, and we can serve, you know, 100 or 150 ad options versus 4 ads that get approved over a month. Those are the brands that are the most successful. And then the brands that are like always bringing something new to market. So instead of having a hero SKU and having that be like the single variant, our brands that have newness that they can like bring people back to site. And then we don't have to just acquire a new customer, but actually sell to that same customer over and over. That's what's like my favorite model. So a drop model mixed with like an easy team that approves creative.
Because that drop model creates
momentum
and inherent scarcity as part of the business model.
Yeah.
Right. And makes it a social event more so than just like a cold purchase, right? It's actually something that you're kind of emotionally involved in.
Well, and it's like, it's good when you can send an email or post something or serve an ad and there's news versus here's an angle of my same product that has not changed. And that works too. We have brands that do sell a single SKU or 4 total variants, and they have to be creative in other ways, but they often are offer specific. And so it's really fun to work with brands that are just moving really quickly.
And you mentioned the creative iteration that's so required. And it's funny. I work at Pilot House as well, which is a performance agency, and creative kind of fuels the beast. But and we've, it's funny, we've worked with bigger brands. Actually, because of this podcast, we had, you know, like big multinational conglomerates come on. But that was our big issue with them, is that we could, over a course of a month, get four creatives approved.
Totally.
Or yep. something like that, right? And so how do you balance, because I know, you know, Nick is you know, big in with brands as well and has a lot to say about building brand. How yeah. do you at Sharma Brands balance the bigger brand building initiatives with that need to be like super iterative and scrappy even?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between being like on brand and off brand. There's normally a middle ground, which is, this isn't offensive, but it's not what we've done before. That's the place that I like to live. And I think that I care so much about brand. I'm like a snotty shopper. I truly buy like exactly what I want, and I research it and I compare and I look for everyone else who has like ever bought it. I find every reason not to buy something before I buy it. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about the full purchase journey, and that does require the brand to build itself. So even if we're not working on the organic marketing, we will still advise for, you know, like our first question we're always asked is like, we're running maybe Meta and Google, and then they ask if we want to run TikTok ads. And it's like, well, you don't post on TikTok. You don't have any presence on TikTok. So yes, we can run, and we'd love the opportunity, like let us make creatives, but you have to promise to start posting like at least once a day and have a face to the brand as you post. And so I think brand is built by the team within and by the marketers trusted to like spread the message of the brand, but organic power is what we do, and we power back what they do. And it has to all feel like it's moving quickly. But I think brand and growth are the same, because you're just trying to bring the company to more people.
But you need to kind of loosen the reins up a little bit on that performance marketing side, as long as you've yeah. got a strong base of you brand.
You have to loosen the reins, unless the reins were like meant, like if you already have incredible branding and if you already will approve new styles you haven't tried, as long as they don't break your branding, that's where we want to live, where we follow brand guidelines. There's not a font we wouldn't try that's exactly in their arsenal, but a format that they've never tried is not off brand if it doesn't break their guidelines.
Then Daniel, on your side, you know, being a catcher in the rye of the marketing millennial space, what are some trends or some things that you're seeing in the space?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the biggest ones, and I think we've talked about this before, is like the need to be more efficient than ever. And I think every industry, B2B, like e-commerce, everything, got a influx of a lot of money, and we're allowed to just spend everything. And at those times, Facebook was cheaper to execute. TikTok was easier to execute. All these platforms were easier to execute. And now what people are really, you start seeing in the industry, is that people are looking at the full funnel approach and looking at like the whole journey and looking at conversion rates down funnel, looking at like post-purchase and retention and loyalty and all that stuff, where before, like, it was just like, let's get as much in the funnel as possible. And like, if some bleeds out, it bleeds out, but like, let's get as much as, because we have all this money to spend. And like you said before, like, brand is what's going to keep, that's an effect of brand for a lot of people who had a lot of VC money. It's like, you saw this big growth, and now you see like those big D2C brands who are just starting to tumble because they had either one SKU, or they didn't build a brand, or so efficiency is one of the biggest trends that is going to keep going and keep going, in profitability, and how can we be more profitable. And I know Ari sees it all the time with how people spend on her side as well.
Yeah, how about that, Ari? Where are you seeing brands gain the most efficiency?
Gaining the most efficiency, I guess, depends on the brand. But my favorite sort of moment is when something goes like a bit off plan. So we have a brand that launched a product and it sold out within like 7 minutes, and it was not meant to. And they had like a new launch, but they always have new launches. And this is like the launch that actually did it. And so this is the new category they're trying. And so their efficiency here they immediately were going to put it on pre-order, which I hate pre-order because pre-order never happens unless it's in the warehouse. It actually like scares the actual crap out of me. And so we stopped them right. It was like a Friday afternoon and this whole thing went down. And instead of them going on pre-order and restocking it in 2 weeks and just having a pre-order and taking the money because they wanted the cash, the efficiency actually was gained a little later when we built a wait list and we now like stole the playbook of Road Skin, which every Wednesday at 9 a.m. they magically have new stock that comes back and you set your alarm and it's the same product over and over and over. And the efficiency is gained like in the behavior of letting a single product, like we can drive to a wait list for less money and get the email and then we're able on the launch to blow it out versus like having the product in stock for 30 days. So I guess efficiency is gained like sort of case by case, but usually when you can like create your own wave and then sort of like resist the urge for like that day's sale sometimes.
That's very cool. I just got off of a debate podcast with a SaaS provider and a couple brands. We're talking about the SaaS ecosystem. And one of the points that came up is if you're a SaaS player that can help someone optimize their ad spend, whether it's like better matching or better retargeting, that to me seems like an area. And to the people in this debate, like that seemed to be because you're already going to spend seven figures on ads. Right. So it's such a clear path. Are there any tools that you're finding brands are using to increase efficiency in their ad spend? Well,
I mean, for us, we use, so I kind of think of it all like I'm a Northbeam girl, not sponsored. I just love Northbeam and we use Northbeam more often than not. We also use Triple Whale. It works great depending on the size of the brand. So for us, like efficiency first is gained when you can see what actually is causing you, like where are you actually spending, what's actually working. So we like, that's a place. I think a place too is first party data. So either ListTrak, GXP, or Black Crow and their predictive model, I think there's a lot of room once the site visitor is there, like to treat them like you know them and to pop up at the right time and to like actually capture the traffic versus just thinking, okay, if I can get them to the landing page and if they don't convert, then I'll go retarget them again, but actually like trying to get them to take the action and keep them and own them. So I'd say like in first party data, that's where there's a lot of efficiency. We also use Amped, which I really like, which is sort of like paired well with Black Crow or ListTrak, and it's a like better pop-up. And so that also, like if we think of Black Crow for efficiency, they have predictive models that also can feed back into Meta and give us better targeting lists and audiences. And so I'd say like Northbeam, Black Crow or ListTrak, Amped are sort of my like minimum stack. But efficiency too, like not software is better creative and just someone like truly caring about the account and turning off ads that aren't working and also having patience to like let ads get to the spend you've all agreed to before you turn them off. For us, we media buy 7 days a week. And so we have efficiencies just in sort of attention as well.
And then when it comes to platforms, are there any platforms, ad platforms or growth platforms, marketplaces, networks that you think brands are either over-indexed or under-indexed? Let's maybe start with under-indexed. Do you think there's any brand and any of these spots that brands are under-indexing on as a rule?
I think not as a rule. I'd say TikTok as cheap traffic or TikTok shop as a way to get more views. I feel good about it. And I think that it's a place where most of our brands that are doing well on Meta and have efficiencies and enough traffic on Google, then it makes sense for us to go explore another channel like TikTok. So I'd say TikTok, TikTok Shop have worked really well. This is like a very controversial answer, but I have a brand that, again, kills it on TikTok, kills it on Meta, kills it on Google, as every brand that kills it on Meta and TikTok would. That when we turn off Pinterest spend, even though Pinterest in platform, like we don't trust it, it's not. When we turn off Pinterest spend, which is so inexpensive to us, everything gets harder. So it's sort of our like true top of funnel. But no one says like go spend a ton of money on Pinterest. I'm talking about like $700 a month or sometimes on a big month spend, maybe $700 a week. For us, Pinterest for that brand has been really helpful because that customer is seeing it and then we're catching them. But because we're using something like Northbeam, we can see it. I'd say that might be like my exploratory channel. I think podcast ads really depend on the read and the host, but I've had a few brands be like pretty disappointed.
I think it can be really hit and miss depending on all of those factors.
Yeah. You have to like pay enough for the good shows, but you have to be like comfortable that even the good shows might not work if you don't do a good job of briefing in the good shows. But I've seen it go both ways.
I saw a recent tweet or LinkedIn post you made about Walmart as well. Yes. And I feel like that they're making a big play in the space, and it's not, everyone thinks about it being on Amazon and now Amazon ads to sweeten the pot there. But Walmart offers the same thing. Walmart ads. Are you seeing clients see some success there as well?
Yes. I think Walmart Marketplace is another one. It depends on your product, as does TikTok. But I think if you have a consumable product, absolutely, it's like, couldn't think of something better, even just to help you go show Costco that you're on Walmart. Like, I think it is helpful just to show scale and to get more numbers and volume to show people your brand. And I was a part of the Feastables launch, and so I know how big Walmart, like, you know, actual retail, it can change the whole model. It can change even if you thought of Walmart as your sort of brand plan, and then it becomes, you know, like, they don't sell on D2C anymore. And that was not the plan, at least when I was working on it. And so I think you don't know what channel is like your channel until you go there. And the risk is really low. So I think it's a great one. And I think too, Walmart is friendlier, at least in my experience so far, like, to brands than Amazon, where you can get more support from their team.
Yeah. They're trying to enter the market, so they've got to be nice. Exactly. A little bit more, right?
Exactly.
Daniel, anything to add on over-indexed or under-indexed channels?
I would say, I think a lot of people are over-indexing on influencers because a lot of brands don't know how to work with influencers, one. And then two, like, the influencers they work with don't know marketing. So that's different than UGC and stuff like that. I'm talking about like pay to play, like posts and stuff like that. I do think there's benefits on like having long-term partnerships with influencers. You see that working way better than just one-off and thinking that someone has an audience, it's going to work. I think that's, well, I mean, it's way different in B2B because I think that space is new and there's actual expertise there. A lot of people just bet on bigger audience and stuff like that. But I do think, like I said, it depends on also product, who you work with, who's in charge of that program. But I think most of the time, some brands don't know how to work with the influencers. And then the other side, like, since they don't know how to work with the influencers don't know how to say things that have a hook, like, that is very marketable.
While being authentic at the same time.
Yeah, and be authentic, yeah. So they know how to create content, but they don't know how to do both. So the best influencers know how to do both. That's what I'm seeing as well.
Yeah. I think that's a great shout. I actually just did a podcast with head of growth at Hexclad, and he was just talking about how they totally scrapped their sort of like one-off influencer for influence's sake program and have switched to one where it's just more about product seeding, making sure your product is like a feature in their life, which is easy for Hexclad because it's the best pan you'll ever use, or that I've used. And so you're going to get a lot of organic, authentic content rather than a constant pay-to-play thing. You're just like, hey, you're going to have this, you're going to give this pan to your kids probably. And so maybe, you know, you're going to have this like long-term relationship. What do you see as the influencer marketing playbook at Charma Brands, Ari?
I think it's definitely like, there's obviously picking the right people, having the right offer, showing the right product at the right time, but also where are you landing that deal? Because so often, you know, you can obviously like, I think Hexclad does it well. And I know you're talking about Connor, and Connor kills it, but also Matt Cowan, who's on the Hexclad team. He like, even in each DM that he sends to each person that they're seeding to, he's like only seeding and reaching out to someone if he knows enough about them to think it's actually worth it to send their product. So he's not just like sending a macro out. He's actually physically typing on his phone, like, hey Daniel, like, I love tennis too. Like, I don't have any like tennis like rackets to sell you, but like, I think you'll probably get hungry. Like, do you want to like have like, I'd love to send you some pants. And like, instead of it just being like, okay, here's a list of 100 people, like, you go do it, giving it to someone on the team who like might not know or might have too many like deals to strike on their plate. And so they're not actually like tailoring the offer, the product, and the comms. And that's on organic, but on paid too, I guess our playbook is fewer better. So if it's going to be paid, the same way on podcasts, you can really kind of get pwned if you don't have the numbers, if you don't really know what shows you're about to go spend money into, even if it's not as much money as you have to spend. I think we'd rather do one deal with maybe Lauren Bostic from The Skinny Confidential and have her do a 360 deal where she has them on her show and then she has a code that has her name on it, and then it leads to a product that's co-branded or that has at least her signature on it. And then it's on her Instagram and also on the brand's Instagram, and they're doing a partner post. I'd rather spend like a ton of money and do one of those a quarter than pay 20 people who have like less sell-through data because they have like maybe flashier audiences.
And xCloud's the ultimate example of that because they just went all the way to the top with like the ultimate influencer with Gordon Ramsay and made an equity deal with him. So it was like a lifetime deal with him. And now they don't play as much in the mushy middle. Now they go for just authentic people using, you know, creators using these products.
Yeah. And xCloud, I've worked with xCloud since 2022. And so xCloud too, they did a Hailey Bieber deal last year. Like they're, even though you're right, they only sort of are playing at the top, they are still playing at the top, not just with Gordon. And I think it's really like not everyone has xCloud's budget, but everyone could spend a lot more time on their organic comms. And most people don't.
Elaborate on that a little more. What, like, because we're in this age of AI now where, every time before I do a podcast, I'll take the pre-interview and I'll put it into AI and I'll have it come up with some questions. I don't use them very much. But what are the ways that brands that might be tempted to use AI or canned responses, what are some of the key ways that they need to keep putting that human touch in?
I think it's like I think for organic messaging and seeding and all that, same point, like you have to tailor your comms into the person and also time it to when they're online. Daniel and I have a friend who is like a known Twitter personality. Like he makes, like that's his living, is he posts these really fun threads and then they go to his newsletter and then they buy his technology. And he, when he's DMing someone that he wants to do an interview with or wants to write a thread about, in order to first like strike up when he DMs them, he writes them like after they tweet. So he knows they're on Twitter. And so he can go and see like that's the most likely time if they send the DM like to hit this person and like get a shot at it. Because that takes more time than, you know, okay, I get like the most like spammy requests on Twitter all the time. And in, I'm never going to reply. But if one person writes like a really thoughtful message to me when I happen to be online, that's like about the thing I just tweeted, and then it has their ask and it's not too long. That's sort of like the opposite of what everyone's trying to do when everyone wants to be more efficient. And for us too, for unscalable practices, we have true copywriters that might use AI if they can't think of a word, but we don't write ad copy that's AI-based. We don't write email copy or SMS copy or landing page copy. We have true like time allotted for original thought for every page we make, every ad we make, every ad copy. And we are using tools that exist, but not even like taking them and editing them, more like in a pinch if we can't think, and then not using it, but being like, okay, that inspired this. So I'd say we're more manual, and I think more manual is great because everything's sounding the same. And if I see one more like LinkedIn post or one more Instagram caption that's like, let's go on a journey with a rocket emoji, that's, it like makes me want
to. You can tell right away.
Like I think
people, when it's AI, really, right?
You can tell. And I don't even think people are using like ChatGPT-4. I think they're on like the 3.5 and it's free. And it feels all the opposite of what feels authentic or cool. And I think if you think about building brand, I don't want anyone reaching out to any of my brands in like some canned, like lame macro. That's gross.
And the same thing applies to community building, I imagine, Daniel. You gotta come raw, come authentic, and be real with it. Because that, I'm always amazed when I see like just how much engagement you're getting at the Marketing Millennials on posts. And that just comes from like really touching a nerve, being authentic with people.
It comes from being consistent for a long period of time and just showing up. And when Marketing Millennials first started, it was more like to hype up other marketers and cool ideas. Like that was like the point of like the page. And we've been around so long and been consistent on the feed that there is a difference with like community shows up. And I look at the comments and see that people are tagging each other and having conversations, and I'm not even like involved in those conversations. So yeah, it comes from hitting a nerve, but being in the comments, understanding what the nerves actually are, being responding to people, other people's posts, and seeing what those nerves are. Because sometimes comments are the best content when it comes to social. It's a great way to test at a low risk way to just comment and see how many likes the comment gets or how many people engage with the comment and see, oh, you hit a nerve with the comment, and then make content out of that. And also being involved in communities around like being in it. I think what people don't do enough is to be a great community, you have to be a great consumer too and understand what your audience actually likes, actually the pains they say. And yeah, I always say that Mark Millennials is a break in the LinkedIn feed. Like that's what the intention is. It's just a break from like everybody trying to be like the thought leader of the year.
I was just talking to a TV advertiser and they brought up the Calm example as an ad. And they just bought the Calm ad that they've never been able to beat is literally just, here's 30 seconds of like forest sounds and breathing.
Like brown noise.
Yeah, Brad, it's just like an un-ad as their ad, and it's served them extremely well. So I see, I always enjoy the Marketing Millennials post in my feed of ridiculous things on LinkedIn.
And it's also good. I think there's also different strategies, and I get a lot of like, why do you do this strategy and why not? But I think the strategy is like, if you have middle funnel content, that's great. You're the point of like, top of funnel is to get as much attention to get someone down to middle funnel. And if you can make someone have a feeling top of funnel and bring them into middle funnel, they already have some sort of reaction to you and they know your vibe from what you're doing, and you bring them into the next part and it's more in depth. I like to call it social Costco sampler, and then like the next part is like the actual full meal. So I think if you don't have a middle funnel, like that's when you start going in depth and social, and that's the only place you could post. But if you have places to drive people to, like the point of marketing, I don't care what anybody says, is to get attention. Like if you're not getting attention, you're not going to win. And if you're not in people's minds, you're not going to win. So get as much attention. If I'm in the feed enough, someone just sees Marketing Millennials, like they'll know, not even sees the post, then I'm winning that day with my audience.
Speaking of funnel, one of the things we talk about a lot recently is sort of like true top of funnel efforts. And we talked about influencers, and the right kind of influencers are going to give you more incremental eyeballs to the top of your funnel. But at Sharma Brands, Ari, what are some other true top of funnel efforts? You mentioned podcasts as well, but what are some true top of funnel marketing efforts that you're seeing work really well?
I think top of funnel is usually a lot of medium swings versus like one big swing. And so like one TV spot you can't afford, you know, in prime time during the NBA finals game 6, I would rather consider like, if we're thinking experimental, we're thinking, what can we do that we might not attribute back? I'd rather they go like connected TV on Bravo and do the same thing for the same budget. So top of funnel is still pretty measured with us. And even let's say if we're ever running any non-conversion event, you know, in Meta, which is rare, we would spend a very small amount of our budget on any sort of awareness ad. We would never, like some accounts, or even like I've had people apply to work at Sharma Brands and we're doing a Meta audit, and I'm just sitting there asking them like to take an account and let us know what they think. And they might say like, you know, 95% of spend is in conversion. I would like make it more 50-50 to awareness, and I like just want to die. And like, so these are like, to me, top of funnel isn't just like throwing money at the top of your funnel and hoping it comes back to you. It's like, okay, with the 5% awareness, why don't we make that like a video views campaign? And then we retarget the little like video viewers if they get to minute like X, and then we do this with them and we show them this offer. Like you, I think it's not just a big swing and you do what it needs to do. You have to like measure the big swing with a bunch of really like bottom of the funnel safe activities that support it.
And plan the big swing. Plan the big swing as well, right? Yeah. Like build up, know what your big swing is going to be by making a bunch of smaller swings that you know will work, right?
Right. And it's measured, or it's like seed the product to that person. And then if they post and if you get a good result, then do a bigger deal with them versus just like being so lucky that you got them to like reply to you that you're like, here's 50K, like, let's do it. Like, it's too scary.
I also think a lot of people forget like the long-term plays of brand, like brand awareness and awareness campaigns, like showing up on social, like Ari was saying, or like SEO tactics that people are searching for some problem that you're having. I think like there are those big swings and pay that you can do to get the initial attention and get a lot of people in the funnel. But there's those brands that who are doubling down in the organic side of it as well, and know that's important, and know that's also like when Ari shops, for example, she always goes to look at like the Instagram page and see who's following that brand or that hotel or whatever to see if it like actually is a cool brand or not. So like those little things that people don't think is like actual awareness becomes awareness because it's like credibility somewhere else that you aren't building. And if you just rely on paid and the well gets more expensive, you don't have anything else to like fall back on. And that's what a lot of brands happens. I know in B2B that happens a lot. Like people just spend and it gets more expensive. And then the cost per customer that comes, the CAC that comes in gets more and more higher and higher. And then they have no organic, no SEO, no anything to fall back on that's long term that should always be building in the background while you're thinking about big swings on paid as well.
I think that's a great shout. With Pilot House, there were 17 people when I started. I think there are 180 people now. It's been wild. And you reach a point where it's like brands will come in and they'll be like, hey, we want you to do our Facebook. We want you to do our Google. But you reach a point with brands when they're like, we want omni-channel strategy. We don't want just individual spends going out in these various places. So Ari, sitting where you sit across all these brands, across all channels, like how do you handle that strategy piece of things? Where you're not just coming in and being like, okay, we'll spend all your budgets various places, but how are you kind of all pulling it together into a central strategy?
I think like we're running an e-commerce business with them. And so like I now focus on growth, but I was an e-commerce manager for my entire career, like in-house at a single brand. I mean, I was a little bit of a job hopper. So I like worked at some big, big brands, but my job wasn't marketing. It was e-commerce like manager. Like I ran the Shopify store. I was in charge of our like activations of all of the ideas that the marketing team had. And so for us, like we think about all of these channels, but like where are we landing them? Like what is actually like the buying experience of how does it actually all work together? And I think too, even if my job or if our scope is a meta scope, we always are looking at what the offer is when they land and what's the welcome offer and is it better than subscription and is subscription better than welcome? Because to us, like subscription is much better. Like I think there's an imbalance often when you get to a site and you look and it's not your responsibility as maybe their media buyer, but you have to intervene and like control the situation. Because if my goal with you and you're my client is, 4,000 new subscriptions a day, and that's what we're working towards on Meta. But then the welcome offer is 20% off, and the subscription offer is also 20% off, and the welcome offer can go apply to one time. Then, like, what are we doing? And so I think it's us, like, sort of taking control as their go-to-market partner and making sure that we're landing all of our traffic in a safe place. So we're all of the channels and all of the teams and the e-commerce manager who set up all of these things behind the scenes that maybe is not even on our calls. They probably were only told like their goal is to grow this or conversion rate on this or one time subscription doesn't matter. They just care about overall conversion and that's their goal. But we have to like help sort of be a second set of eyes as new people to the business and making sure that all the efforts are like properly weighted. because even on a podcast test that my brand just ran, we had a whole fight basically because the podcast offer that the shows got a read off was stronger than their subscription offer. And because they had just paid so much for this podcast spot, but it's like, what about, we now have these codes floating around the world that have nothing to, like, what that show there, what if they get 19 redemptions and we've like created a bigger problem on the back. So I think it's just much more connected than we see. So you have to be responsible. And even like on a ad creative scope only, we would still sometimes like send it through with like a mock of their new like homepage hero or landing or PDP and like not pay just to like be like, why don't you try this? And just like take control of it, even if it's not in your scope.
Knowing what you guys know about both the, you know, the brands outwardly, as well as what you might know about brands internally, what are some, like, we mentioned HexClad, and to me, they're HexClad, True Classic. These are companies that are just, they've just scaled so aggressively and so holistically. They have such a good organic presence. They have great content. They've got great ads. They've got a great website, great product, great experience. What are some other brands that you think out there are like really just nailing it and doing it well?
So I'm obsessed with Derf Avenue. It's spelled D-J-E-R-F. It's this Swedish influencer, and she has a clothing brand that's now become a hair care brand. There is not a better influencer creative meets like D2C excellence meets like inclusivity. Like her brand, even from the very beginning, showed the clothes in her offices on real people, not even models. Like the casting calls will be like, I need a size 8 with like red hair tomorrow. Like, I'd love to meet you. And then it's an open call to her customers. And like the models on her site are real people, but also Sophia Richie Grange that did a deal and a collab with Derf Avenue. And Matilda, who's the founder, Matilda Derf, she is like a fashionista that people copy for her hair, but she's selling a clothing brand. And over time now she just launched a hair care brand. And these are like sort of the brands of tomorrow. And they're a different customer, like True Classic and HexClad. They have nothing to do with Derf Avenue, except I know a lot of people that have HexClad pants and Derf Avenue clothes. And so something that both brands are doing is working. And I think that not every brand has to look the same to like be run as well. And that's a brand that every flyer they make, every pop-up is like to the tooth. It's like perfect. And it's so carefully thought out. And it's also just so different than what every brand is doing. And then there's brands like even Set Active, which is now copied. So it looks like what they're doing is generic. And it's like an activewear brand. It's kind of like blowing up. But it's an LA brand and it has a founder that's posting online and has a Substack and all these things. And I think there's like all this question around like, if is what Set Active is doing, is it unique? Because then all the brands go do it too, or like they're actually being unique the same way HexClad and Ridge and all the big brands, they might be doing something similarly, but it's not to the same customer, or it is, and it's just done in its own way. I think the brands that I mentioned are sort of talking to a different person. They're talking to a female customer usually, and they're doing it in a way that like is definitely worth studying. And some of the Derf Avenue examples I use to feed my like supplement brand that is serving creatine to men, and it also works. So it all is connected.
Dan McCormick, love that. Love his creatine brand and what he's doing there. Daniel, anything to add on yours? Any brand out there that you're seeing just kill it?
Ari is the queen of knowing what shopping. A brand that I've seen do really well, which is kind of funny because I've been just shopping it, is OnCloud.
They
picked the right person with Roger Federer. They picked up and coming young players that weren't like the best in the world yet, but now they've become the best in the world. And now I'm like looking at all their like tennis stuff and stuff like that. And like you see on their social, there's like on Instagram, you can shop it and you can go to their site. And it's like you could see Ben Shelton, like say Ben Shelton's the athlete. You go to the site, it directs you to Ben Shelton's like gear. It's all sold out. Like the power of like picking those like small influencers early, and the power of like just using like equity, like Gordon Ramsay and Hexclad. Like, that's a brand that it just came out of nowhere in like the athletic space, and now it's just, especially like also picking their lane, like tennis and pickleball and all these like sports are getting such a boom right now. So it's like they got the tennis so quickly, where like other brands were like falling behind on that avenue. And there was existing brands that were winning, and they just paved their own way. So that's one that I think it's just came out of nowhere.
I think it's a great shout to go into such an industry that has so many like established players, and to make as much progress as they have. I talked with Tony Yu from Vessi about this, and another part of that is just the form factor, the fact that they introduced like a whole new silhouette, essentially a shoe that instantly is recognizable, like Hoka, and now other brands are going to try to mimic those silhouettes in some ways, but they've already sort of been set as the platonic form.
I remember Hoka, my boss, like 7 years ago, was like, you should buy Hoka. It's like, it used to be like known as like the shoe for like bigger guys, like taller guys and stuff like that. It wasn't like known. And then it became just this lifestyle brand, which is so crazy that it just came out of nowhere. And now they just did a collab with Free People that everybody's talking about too. They really came out of nowhere and like became like more of a lifestyle shoe. And that's what On Cloud's doing too. But they're doing different than the other D2C players that were doing shoes, is that they have multiple SKUs and multiple categories that they can win in different categories. And I think On Cloud is like starting to win in tennis, and especially in the US market. It's cool to see.
I saw you were a college athlete, and I'm going to assume it was in tennis.
I wish. I'm a big tennis guy now, but I played college football, but now like that's my competition of choice.
Yeah, that's good.
Literally the opposite, but now I love it. It's like my favorite sport. Oregon attack, I'm obsessed. So
much more civilized game. I played a game yesterday. I love it as well. Last question, guys. I got to go pick up my daughter here, and you may not want to give this up, but if you were, I don't know if you, maybe Ari, have you started any D2C brands yourself?
And no.
If you haven't, do you have in your, are you gestating?
Yes.
Are you able to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, so my dream of life, which I'll never do, but I want to do desperately, is I want to have a D2C diamond brand that only sells tennis necklaces and bracelets, and only in specific quality. So D, E, and F diamonds, and in 3 different carat sizes and 2 different lengths. And I want it to be like sort of Ring Concierge, which is a really popular D2C jewelry brand that has gold jewelry and all these other types and engagement rings. But the quality of a tennis necklace, Ring Concierge, which I have one, I love it. It's like a K diamond, which is bad. It's really bad. And when you're buying it online, it looks really bright. And when you see it in person, to me, it's amazing. But I want it to be like a Harry Winston level quality without any sort of choice. So then there's nothing to stop you along the way. And I always talk about this, and I have a name for it. I'm never going to do it so someone can steal it, because I think this needs to exist because I will buy it. But imagine if it was Harry Winston, but there was no option and it sold online and you didn't have to worry about quality because it's only the best.
I think you can make this happen.
I think I could, but I'm too scared.
I don't see what's holding
you
back.
I'm too scared. Fear. Someone steal it.
Fear is the mind killer. I think the big opportunity right now, there's 2 things I'm interested in. One, I bought a pair of grounding shoes because I read some woo-woo stuff about our like the Earth's magnetic field and how every human has a field.
But isn't barefoot grounding? What are you going to do?
Well, you got to wear shoes sometimes.
So you're constantly grounded.
Yes, you're constantly grounded even
that's
when,
cool.
Or the other one is I saw a big thing about like how every one of our athleisure is made with like tons of like microplastics, and you're sweating in this thing, you're changing, you know, you're changing molecules. This, like, there's got to be a really good alternative to Lululemon that's like merino wool or alpaca or something like that. I feel like I think like natural fibers athleisure wear is one I'm tracking.
That's cool.
Yeah, I have 2. I think one, I think business athleisure wear, that like suits and stuff that is a leisure wear that people can like the same fabric, but it's like you can go to like some brands do it, but they don't do it like extremely well. Like Lululemon has good pants and Kid and Aces. And then the other one I want to do is I want to disrupt like the there's really good, like there's the tennis, like what do you call it? Like warehouse stores and stuff like that, where they curate stuff, are terrible branding, terrible, like the site experience is terrible. And I think there's like a space to like be the site that's cool for tennis gear. And I want to start that.
All right, investors, if you're listening, you got three e-commerce minds here just looking for the right push to start our businesses. So I think maybe we should meet on a regular basis and see how our dreams are going. But perfect. For now, guys, this was super cool. Thanks for coming on today. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having us. So nice to meet you.
Yeah, you guys as well. Good to see you again, Daniel. Quick shout out. Go to the Marketing Millennials. If you're not, subscribe to the newsletter. Go to Millions. I'm going to go subscribe right now. And that's G. It's not with the number two, is it? It's T-O.
No, it's the number two. Lower. No, it's T-O.
Never the number two. We can all agree on that, never. Right? It's always
cool.
D.
It's not cool.
It's B2B. It is B2B, unfortunately, but it is DTC.
Yeah. No
go two. Okay, good. We're all on the same page.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you're not a subscriber to our newsletter, you can do that right now at directtoconsumer.co. I'm Eric Dick, and this has been the D2C Podcast. We'll see you next time.